Hello, and welcome to Issues and Ideas. Coming up on today's program, travel correspondent Tom Wilmer takes us to Bristol, Tennessee, to visit a new museum scheduled to open this summer. He talks with Dr. Jessica Turner, who is director and chief curator at the new Birthplace of Country Music Museum. Also, Stephen DeLuque and Chrissy Hewitt bring us another edition of Ears on Art, honoring Ina May Overman, who died last month. Ina May created colorful fused glass works that often took the form of window hangings. Up first, though, we hear from the San Luis Obispo County Land Conservancy about recent milestones and projects that will affect our region.
I'm Marisa Waddell with you on Issues and Ideas. There's a group in San Luis Obispo County that is working hard to protect and restore land that has important scenic, agricultural, habitat, and cultural values for the people and the wildlife in our area. The Land Conservancy of San Luis Obispo County has already permanently protected over 14,000 acres locally. They've assisted in creating the popular Bob Jones Trail between San Luis Obispo and Avila Beach. They have planted thousands of native trees, restored miles of creek habitat, and rescued the historic Octagon Barn from collapse. And I have a couple of folks from the Land Conservancy with me today. They are Executive Director Kyla Detman and Board Trustee Pete Jenny. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you for having us.
Good to be here.
So you have received some great news in the last month about the Octagon Barn. It's now listed on the National Register of Historic Places. Can you tell me why the barn is important and what makes it worth preserving?
Well, we're very excited about this. Being recognized at a national level is pretty special. As a former parks guy, it's especially nice. This is a program administered by the National Park Service, so I feel kind of kindred spirits in that regard. It goes a long way toward acknowledging what we locally have seen for a long time, that this is a special place. What we found out is there just aren't too many buildings like this particular one around the country. And in fact, in California, there are only two other octagonal barns. So it's particular, the shape is the character that was really special about this barn. Mm-hmm. And the fact that it now will be eligible for additional special granting funds is really important to us in the long haul.
So that's why it's important that it's listed, just not just to be a special place, but because it brings other funding and things like that.
Yeah, other funding as well as other protections. And so it's not quite as easy to change or alter a historic structure that has that status. So we're hoping that keeps the barn around for a much longer time.
And what does it take to get a landmark registered or listed as a national historic place?
Well, it takes a very actually detailed application process to explain why the barn, you know, why it was important, why it, what the history of it was, what we did to preserve the integrity of the barn and keep it in its character from when it was originally built. So they review that very carefully, the application, and they look at whether or not it should receive that designation.
Lots and lots of research. Lynn Landwehr, who is our volunteer historian, just put in hundreds of hours, not only getting the background story on the barn to be able to tell that story to the folks that are responsible for the decision, but also to, you know, just the paperwork, the forms to fill out to tell that story is a very complicated. It was probably a year's work to get to that point, culminating in a public hearing up in Sacramento that I guess that was in this fall that we finally got the word. So it's a big deal for us, and I think it shares, again, as I said, that other people recognize how important the site is, not just the Conservancy.
Mm-hmm. So the Octagon Barn is just on the south edge of San Luis Obispo, just off Highway 101. For folks who haven't seen it, can you describe it for me?
Wow, it's beautiful, really neat structure. Obviously, it has eight sides. It's a very stately building right along South Higuera, just south of town. It's kind of a stark contrast to when suddenly you leave the industrial area kind of San Luis Obispo, and there's this beautiful barn, very pastoral setting around it. It takes you back to that time when dairies were prolific in our county, and just a really beautiful setting.
I think the thing that always strikes me, and it still does every time I walk into it, is how much bigger it is on the inside than it looks on the outside. It's a really large space, and that's one of the reasons we're so excited about it, because people are drawn to it for what that space can accommodate. We're looking forward to the day when we can have concerts there, we can have films, we can have weddings, we can have all kinds of public gathering. And as Kyla said, you know, it's right at the urban edge of town, and it's a perfect bridge between the agricultural elements of this county and the city. Kind of, you know, the two things that have been a separation that have divided this community. Folks in town don't always understand folks who make their living in ag, and yet ag is really the reason this place came to be and is still an important facet of San Luis Obispo County. So we see it as actually a place where those two elements can come together quite physically on one side and learn more about each other. So we'll be sharing more about the history and the culture involved in this county through its agriculture at the barn.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Marisa Waddell, and my guests today are from the Land Conservancy of San Luis Obispo County, Kyla Detman, who's the executive director, and Pete Jenny, who's a board trustee. And we're talking about the Octagon Barn on the south edge of San Luis Obispo, and we'll be talking about some of the other projects that the Land Conservancy is working on right now. But it's an important time for the barn. It just received a National Historic Place listing, and you also received a chunk of money last year, a $260,000 grant for the barn. Tell me about that and how you'll use the money.
Yeah, that was another major milestone for us, a significant amount of funding to help us advance what we want to do out there. Really what that grant pays for is the water and irrigation infrastructure at the barn. We plan to landscape around the barn to basically make the whole site very inviting. And this also pays for those plants, native plants we put in at the barn site once we do, you know, make some more improvements. And it was through the Environmental Enhancement and Mitigation Program through the California Natural Resources Agency. So it is state funding to mitigate effects of the Los Osos Valley, the updates to the Los Osos Valley Road interchange over 101. So it's helping to enhance the area around that interchange, and really is a great recipient site for those funds, and we're really grateful to have gotten that grant.
Mm-hmm. And what have you done so far to restore the Octagon Barn? I know lots of volunteers have been involved.
Well, going back to 1996, hundreds of thousands of hours have gone into the physical restoration of the building. Anyone who had seen it in those days or sees the pictures that we have of it knows that the barn was literally falling down on itself, and it came very close to being totally demolished. So there was restoration really from the ground up, from the foundation all the way to the shingle, all the way to replacing every single shingle on the roof. And in fact, you can go into the barn today and see the telltale reminders of that work, because there's still some of the original white paint. That was the state of the art for clean technologies. You painted things white in the dairy barn so you knew if it was clean or not. Mm-hmm. If it still looked white, it was clean, so you're doing the right things. You can still see some of that white paint on the structures that are original, and then you can see what was replaced during that construction process that no longer has the white paint. But that stabilization process is everything associated with now making the site usable for the public. It's one thing to keep the building from falling down. It's another to get it to the point where we can have public assembly and people can safely come and use the site. And while it hasn't been very impressive because it's been behind the scenes, it's been a huge amount of work and very important work to get the permits that are necessary for that public assembly side. That was all completed about a year and a half ago. And now that we have this grant, we're actually going to be able to start work on the site itself, because we have a total of 6 acres all told to work with. Mm-hmm. So we can accommodate the parking that will be necessary, the restrooms to support public use, the ADA accessibility issues, and everything else that will really make that site work as a public venue.
So do you have a projected date when it will be available for public use?
That's everyone's favorite question. We get that asked a lot. We're looking at breaking ground on the site in 2014. We expect it to be open to the public in late 2015.
Okay.
That's our goal, and we think that's a realistic goal.
So we have a little while to wait before we can go in and start having concerts and parties there.
Yes. That's right.
Yes.
So what's next? You said that you are going to be doing some landscaping, you're going to be working on accessibility and parking and things like that. What do you need to be able to complete the project?
Well, we have one very important partner in this whole process, and that's San Luis Obispo County Parks. As you mentioned, the Bob Jones bike trail is an integral piece of what's going on at the barn, and we are in fact going to be a staging area for the Bob Jones. We're going to share our parking facilities with the bike trail. Which is a nice complimentary use because our events will happen mostly in the evening hours. The bike trail, of course, will be used during the daytime hours. So while we will begin the infrastructure work that this new grant's going to pay for probably this year, we'll pause at the end of 2014, and we're hoping in 2015 early the county will be in and will have completed their environmental work on the Bob Jones so that they can put in the parking facilities that we will both share. Once that's done, we can come back and finish the landscaping without having to tear up. You know, we'll be complementing the work that each site is doing. Mm-hmm. So that's one reason it's taking some time is we're having to coordinate a very big project, not just the barn, but this very big project of the Bob Jones Bike Trail at the same time.
Mm-hmm. And the reason the Bob Jones Bike Trail is so integral to the process is because it goes right by the barn, right?
Yep. Exactly. It is technically the starting point, at least within the unincorporated part of the county. It's the starting point of the Bob Jones Bike Trail. One of the features that will be on the site is we're going to restore a feature that used to exist on site. It's not the very same windmill, but we're putting a windmill back on, and that will be the visual start of the Bob Jones Bike Trail. So we envision people saying, meet me at the windmill, and we'll go for our ride down to Avila from the barn.
Okay. You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Marisa Waddell, and my guests are Kyla Detman, who's the Executive Director of the Land Conservancy of San Luis Obispo County, and also Pete Jenny, who's a board trustee. So tell me about some of the other projects that the Land Conservancy is working on.
You did a great job of summarizing our mission at the beginning. I think some of the projects that we would like to highlight are within our strategic plan, which is a 5-year plan that we just finished, that focuses on really how we sum up our organization: conserve, care, and connect. Mm-hmm. So on the conserve part, that's talking about protecting those special places throughout the county. And we, in the next couple of years, are focused on protecting an 8,500-acre ranch in North County, which is the headwaters or the source of much of the water for Nacimiento Lake. So there we're addressing water supply issues and trying to help keep that resource sustainable. Mm-hmm. We are focused on our work in Los Osos Valley, protect very important farmland in Los Osos Valley, so we'll be looking at that over the next few years. Also, we continue our great work in the Guadalupe Napomo Dunes, trying to address invasive species issues there and improve habitat for local wildlife. And then we're also, in terms of connecting people to the land, we're working on a project down in Napomo and Rio Grande area on Black Lake Canyon, a little conservation education park for the public. So we've got a lot of different things in the hopper, and we hope that everybody stays tuned to what we're up to over the next few years because there's some exciting changes coming.
Yeah, that really is a lot. And how would someone keep in touch with what you're doing?
Well, you can always call our office or get on our mailing list. We do email. We also do our newsletter, quarterly newsletter. So if people just want to stay informed, they can always donate and become a member. Any donation makes people a member. So that's the best way to stay in touch with us. But we have an active website, Facebook, all the social media outlets. You can always just call our office.
Mm-hmm. And what is your website?
Our website is www.lcslo.org.
Which stands for Land Conservancy of San Luis Obispo.
Yep.
So if someone wants to get involved and volunteer for a Land Conservancy, how does one do that?
Same thing. You can just call or walk into the office. We're always happy to see a smiling face and send an email. We also have volunteer forms people can fill out what they're interested in doing or what their skill sets are. We can, you know, a lot of people think of, oh, I want to volunteer to go plant trees. And that's we can accommodate that for sure. We can really use people's help with that. But we also can have people help us with those things that are a little less obvious, you know, office work or help teach some kids how to lead a hike. You know, there's all sorts of different ways to get involved.
And what's your phone number?
Our phone number is 544-9096.
And the website address is lcslo.org. Thank you so much, Kyla Detman and Pete Jenny from the Land Conservancy of San Luis Obispo County.
Thank you so much for having us.
For Issues and Ideas, I'm Marisa Waddell.
And this is Issues and Ideas on Public Radio KCBX. Still ahead on today's show, Stephen DeLuque and Chrissy Hewitt bring us another edition of Ears on Art, honoring Ina May Overman, who died last month. But up next, travel correspondent Tom Wilmer takes us to Bristol, Tennessee, to visit the director and chief curator of the new Birthplace of Country Music Museum, which is set to open this summer.
Music, arts, culture, architecture, song and dance, and storytelling are all intrinsic elements that define modern-day northeastern Tennessee. And it's all neatly intertwined with a proud history that predates the Revolutionary War. I'm Tom Wilmer. Come along and join me in Bristol, Tennessee, to visit with Dr. Jessica Turner, the director and head curator at the new Birthplace of Country Music Museum, an affiliate of the Smithsonian Institution, scheduled to open in the fall of 2014.
My name is Jessica Turner. I'm the director and head curator of the Birthplace of Country Music Museum in Bristol. It's a museum construction project that's been in development for several years and finally going to happen and be open August of 2014. This museum represents Bristol's regional history in Appalachian music, but especially the Bristol Sessions of 1927 and 1928. So those were Ralph Peer's recordings for the Victor Talking Machine Company, where the Carter family first recorded, Jimmy Rogers first recorded, also Ernest Stoneman, not his first recording. So why we call ourselves the birthplace of country music when there's music going far back from that, as early as 1924, when Vernon Dalhart first records The Wreck of the Old 97, or Ernest Stoneman first records The Titanic. You know, those first recordings happen in New York, and they happen in Atlanta, and they happen in Camden, New Jersey. So those are, you know, arguably the real birthplaces of country music. Bristol is significant because these were the first commercially successful records.
When shall I see him? Oh, no, never shall I meet him in heaven.
Vernon Dalhart was very successful, but this was really the recognition of, oh my goodness, what a beautiful genre, and the business of the record industry realizing that this is a highly marketable style of music. These hillbilly records, they were called. So marketed as hillbilly records by Ralph Peer with Victor, also by Columbia Records and OK Records, who are all doing their recordings there.
Back in the 20s and 30s, did this become a Nashville of sorts? Was it to draw for people to come to record?
I think Bristol was an anomaly. I mean, what we have in Bristol in the 1920s is a cosmopolitan urban center in Appalachia, and that's why the Bristol Sessions happened here. Ralph Peer came here because he could easily get here on the railway. He came down from New York at the recommendation of Ernest Stoneman, who said, you know, Bristol, there's a lot of music in that region, and Bristol would be a great place to bring these musicians to come and record. And so that's why Ralph Peer came to Bristol for one of these first field recording sessions. And then after Bristol, it was so successful, Columbia went to Johnson City and did their own recording sessions there. And there were recording sessions in Winston-Salem and in Savannah, Georgia, and in Asheville. So after Bristol, the recording industry is traveling to a lot of other cities. And so Bristol is significant because it's one of those places that certain stars like the Carter family and Jimmy Rogers were discovered or recorded here in Bristol. Also, the technology of the time made those Bristol Sessions records a little crisper than the earlier recordings because of the Western Electric microphone. And it just built over time. And what we're doing in the museum is talking about those early recordings, the Carters, Jimmy Rogers, recording technology and sound technology, and also the business of hillbilly records. So what did Ralph Peer do as a businessman? The copyright system that we use today can be credited back to Ralph Peer, that three-part system where the lyrics are copyrighted, the performance is copyrighted, and the music arrangement is copyrighted, comes out of that early music industry.
Tell us about what it's going to be here, what's going to feel and look like.
We're really excited about building this museum because it is paying tribute to that history. But at the same time, we are looking at it in really innovative ways. There's a ton of media going into this museum. There are films being produced for the museum, a lot of interactive databases, listening stations. There's a mixing station where you can mix your own song from the Bristol Sessions with tracks that we've recorded. So we're taking a very innovative approach to history and trying to get people to look at this early sound recording as a piece of really America, and this is American music.
tell my true love, but can't roll a wheel. I can't roll a wheel.
This is popular music in the 1920s. Then later it becomes country music. It becomes bluegrass music. But these genres didn't really exist in the 20s as those such names. Mm-hmm. We're trying to look at that in really innovative ways.
Rockabilly, too.
And rockabilly. You know, that's another genre that gets created as people are out there just making the music that sounds good to them. And that's what we're really looking at. We're also exploring this idea of technology, how technology shapes the way we listen to music. So prior to sound recording, people gathered and performed. And then sound recording changes that, and people are consuming music. Radio comes along the scene, and people are gathering in a home. And then after radio, people are gathering around a TV. And now we're in a day and age where music is less social in that we're not physically together, but sometimes it's more social because we're flinging it to each other across social media. So we're trying to get the younger generation interested in these early recordings by thinking about how you share and carry your music.
Talk to us a little bit about the Carter family and the connection regionally and locally.
This music comes out of this region, Northeast Tennessee, Southwest Virginia, Southeastern Kentucky, Western North Carolina. It's all part of a regional music tradition that has existed for a long time. And the Carters' music comes out of that tradition. A.P. Carter collected these songs, which ironically were then copyrighted to him as arranging the lyrics of. But this is part of an oral tradition, part of a common culture where people just, everybody owns the music. And I think that remains celebrated. It remains in live performance. And looking back at some of those early Carter family music reminds us that these songs are performed by the Carters and also performed by the Powers family and also performed by the Mullins family and performed by people who aren't famous nationally but are famous locally and maybe not famous.
Can you take the trail back in time to Ireland, Scotland, and Wales, and how the music got here?
Absolutely. One of the things that we're doing in the museum, and what a lot of researchers of Appalachian music traditions have done, is traced a lot of this music back to Ireland, to Wales, to Scotland, to Britain, to England, to the British Isles. The fiddle tunes in particular, a lot of those English ballads, these are the songs that are getting recorded onto cylinder in the early 1900s. And so there's, you know, there's a direct connection there that we can see. Also, there's a lot of African-American influence that people are not as quick to recognize, but what you have in Appalachia is this great blending of the African, what became the banjo. The instrument was brought over here by slaves, combined with fiddle music, combined with ballad singing in just a real lively music scene. And then the record industry decides what genres those fit into, which aren't necessarily what people are actually performing day to day. One of the things that we're doing in the museum that we're really excited about, in addition to looking back at the Bristol Sessions, is also looking at the here and now. And one of our theaters is a really fun experience. It's an immersion theater that we're calling the Unbroken Circle.
Oh, can the circle be unbroken by and by, Lord, by and by?
We're drawing on that theme from the Carter family of Will the Circle Be Unbroken? And our Unbroken Circle is looking at contemporary festivals, fiddle conventions, what people are writing and singing right now in a way that makes it very evident that these musics and live performance is very much a living tradition. And people gathering to celebrate music isn't something that we do in order to save the past, but it's something that we do in order to celebrate life. And these exhibits are looking at the revivals over time, the Newport Folk Festival, the Smithsonian, the Folklife Festival, and other revivals of the music that have happened in the past century to make it really impactful nationally and internationally.
And I presume once you're open that you will schedule ongoing live performances.
Absolutely. What we're standing next to our performance and teaching theater, which is a small, very intimate 100-seat theater. It's cabled so that we can record from here, so that we can broadcast from here. But when you're actually here, it's going to be a very small and intimate experience of beautiful acoustic music. And what we hope to do here is have ongoing performances. It will also be fitted so that we can have lectures here, master classes, maybe films about music, and have our own Southern music film series or something like that. We're in the facility. We have educational classrooms. We have a special exhibits gallery. So a lot of what we're going to do is after the museum actually opens, which in the current construction phase keeps me up at night wondering what then. Mm-hmm. But it's very fun and exciting right now.
A little bit about you and your background and how music came into your life and mm-hmm. how you wound up here.
Well, I grew up in Southwest Virginia in the small town of Chilhowie. I studied music as a young adult. I went and studied music and anthropology as an undergraduate student. And then from there, I learned about this field called ethnomusicology. I went to Indiana University and got my master's and my doctorate in folklore and ethnomusicology there, writing about the Carter family and place and tourism and heritage, and also going to China and doing my PhD research there, studying the exact same thing, studying heritage and tourism and how we make our culture relevant by reinventing it constantly. And so those are the things that I studied. I just think that I was in the right place at the right time when I got this position. It's perfect for me. I'm back in my home region, but I'm doing what I trained to do and get to be involved with a really exciting project.
Thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. For further information, you can contact the Birthplace of Country Music at 423-573-1927. My email address is jturner@birthplaceofcountrymusic.org.
Website?
Birthplaceofcountrymusic.org.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
And this is Issues and Ideas on Public Radio KCBX. Coming up at 2 o'clock on KCBX, it's On Being. Novelist Marilyn Robinson and astrophysicist Marcelo Gleiser will connect current discoveries about the cosmos, new territory of understanding our own minds, and our ancient and eternal longing to know where we come from. Also, there are some surprising moments on what a fiction writer and a physicist have in common. That's On Being, coming up in a half hour at 2 o'clock. But now it's time for Ears on Art here on Issues and Ideas. Ears on Art is sponsored by Marshall's Jewelers, creating and selling fine jewelry since 1889. You can visit them on the corner of Higuera and Garden Streets in downtown San Luis Obispo.
Strength and creativity times three. Stay tuned. Good afternoon. I am Chrissy Hewitt. Issues and Ideas continues now with Ears on Art, a twice-monthly program devoted to the exploration of the visual arts. Co-host Stephen DeLuque and I produce it here at the studios of KCBX Public Radio for the Central California Coast. Today's program is in honor of three artists who died this past year. They are Janine Kirkpatrick, Barbara Flynn, and Ina May Overman. In our December holiday storytelling program, Janine's daughter, Rita, shared thoughts about her mother, speaking to a woman's deep creativity and passion for art. That story aired on Wednesday, December 4th, and you can hear it in the KCBX archives under Ears on Art. Barbara Flynn lived on the Central Coast for many years. She was a ceramic artist and owned the business Moonstone Pottery. For several years, she had a regular booth at the Monday Farmers Market in Los Osos. Actually, I first met Barbara at Cal Poly. She was part of the staff of the property management department. It was her job to locate pieces of equipment that were on a master list, but were not always accounted for. Certainly, the art department had many a piece of equipment, so she often came to us, and it was fun over the years to recognize her as she would come through the door carrying her clipboard and saying, "I'm looking for dot, dot, dot," and we would go on the search. She took some ceramic classes at Poly, but I believe her interest in clay started even before that. And when she retired, she went into the business full-time of being an artist. She had a love of history and became fascinated with English pottery from the 16th and 17th century. She would create reproductions of some of these pieces, many of which had secrets to them, and you had to learn how to use them, or otherwise you might spill water all over yourself as you tried to drink, or whatever the piece might be intended for. She loved to travel, and fortunately was able to do that in some of the more recent years. As with Janine and Ina May Overman, Barbara was a strong woman with a good sense of humor, but really knew how to take care of herself. Moonstone Pottery is still listed on the website, so you can have a look at both her studio and some of her work, along with her recent studio partner, Richard Rowe. She is a member of the art community, whom I will miss a great deal. As it turns out, Stephen and I interviewed Ina May Overman a few years ago, and so today we thought it timely to replay that interview. I'll share some thoughts about her at the end. Here now is our October 3rd, 2007 conversation with Ina May Overman.
We're going to be fusing in a slumping with Ina May. Stay tuned. Hello, this is Stephen DeLuque, and you are listening to Ears on Art, a twice-monthly program produced here at the studios of KCBX-FM Public Radio in San Luis Obispo. Today we visit with Ina May Overman, a fused glass specialist who, in her second career after retirement, has decided to start creating beautiful, wondrous works of fused glass. Co-host Krista Hewitt and I traveled to the South County to speak with Ina May.
Good afternoon, Ina May.
How are you, Krista?
I'm doing just fine, and Stephen's here, too.
Yeah, he is.
Glad to have met him.
Pleasure meeting you, too.
We're discussing a genre that we really haven't tackled before, which is working with glass sheet, fused glass, as opposed to blowing glass. Do you have a sense of history of that discipline, or certainly you have a history of you and the discipline?
Well, it's kind of a long story because I started out doing stained glass, which when I retired from the city of Los Angeles, I immediately went to Granada Hills and took a stained glass course. I found out that I really want to do three-dimensional type things. So for some reason or other, the University of Northridge, they gave an advanced stained glass course. And that was the very first time that I managed to do some slumping. And it was a very, very odd procedure compared to what they do today. Now, this would be in about 1978. And anyhow, I just came enamored over that. And I thought, oh, boy. So I made this into a three-dimensional stained glass, which now Dr. Hayashi has. I actually gave it to him because it was a Japanese design. And I made a matching one later on when I lived here, which he also has. So then I went up to Oregon, stayed for a while, and I came back to Pismo Beach, and then I decided I wanted to live here. And I knew that I wanted to live here because I wanted to take advantage of all of the colleges. So I started out a course with Ancock College, mm-hmm. with Bill Sheehan.
Correct.
And I took all of his ceramic courses. I took George Murrow's classes in design. And then I went on to go to Cal Poly. And in 1981, I took a course with George Jurczyk. It was called Glass Forming, which in those days, it was just really medieval. George was just about one step ahead of us, was about all, because he didn't understand some of it either. And, of course, there were no glasses in those days to fuse. We just took stained glass and hoped that it was compatible. So we just had to gamble on that. And I found that this one brand of glass did, and I still to this day use that glass. Summer classes, there was a Mary White came down from San Francisco area and taught us, and then Dan Fenton, who was very well known. These were all summer classes at Cal Poly, of which George was in head of. And then I just kind of went out on my own on that. Then I took Krista Hewitt's class.
You certainly did.
In jewelry making, of which I incorporated some of my fused glass, which I still to this day have. I'm just wondering what you're going to do with all those nice little design things we had to make that were 2 inches square.
I have been thinking about that, too. The reference here is the fact that I am retiring from Cal Poly, and I was packing up my tools from the class, and I was looking around at those and going, I haven't got room for all of them at home, but I think I certainly will bring a few to decorate my studio with. These were little 2-inch squares that students were cutting out as an initial
exercise. Yeah, but don't forget,
exercise.
You have some famous artists there.
I do, and you're one of them.
Sandra K. Johnson, Linda Lewis.
Yes.
Yeah, that was our first introduction to the metal. And then I guess I just went on kind of on my own.
And this career was all on top of another career, right? I mean, you were basically retired by the time you started
doing
this.
Oh, I was retired, but I went on the grand jury. I was on the grand jury for a year. I was a civil service commissioner for 4 years. Then I went to Cuesta and took their foundry, which I really, really enjoyed.
Yeah. Your employment during all of the time before all of these things.
Oh, I worked for 31 and a half years for the city of Los Angeles as a civil engineering designer. Except the last 2 years, I was the first woman public works inspector. And I'm telling you, the contractors just about tore their hair out thinking they had to have a woman telling them what to do. But they learned to love me. And then I retired, and I've just gone on to a different life.
Isn't that nice that retirement allows you that? What sparked your interest in glass particularly?
I don't know. I really don't. I guess it's because you can see through it. And the colors, mm-hmm. the colors. Because I had gone to Pierce while I was working, and I took design and life drawing and drawing and those kind of subjects. But there's not much you can do with that. Not that I wanted to sell these things, but you can't keep everything that you make. You know, so I've been very fortunate. The Art Center has probably sold more of my work than any one place. And I think I've generated at least $10,000 to them from my work, so I feel very good about that.
I wouldn't be surprised. It's just kind of a routine that in some window area near a door, near, you know, something, that there is a piece of yours hanging so that it is catching the light. And I've been there many times when people are going, whoa!
I'm almost 85. I'll be 85 in November. And I am beginning to slow down a little bit.
I guess you're entitled. We're sitting in your living room that definitely has a theme to it.
Egyptian.
And you've picked it up in glass. You've picked it up in, obviously, some objects that you have probably purchased more than made, I would assume.
Well, I made all of these things.
Oh, okay. Count me wrong.
No, but there are some things that I have bought. I mean, naturally, I buy the little statues. I can't make those. But most of the decoration type things I've done, and the lamps I made. And I got a palm tree in here. Two of them, in fact.
And this was inspired because?
I went to Egypt in 1989. Best thing I ever did for myself.
Just pick up and go? Was it a tour?
It was a tour. It was in November, and it was good time of the year, and I just thought it was wonderful. I'd never been in that type of a foreign country before. And I made this gaudy table.
Folks, she is the one that's defined it as gaudy.
It's actually beautiful.
I mean, I got the floor tiles from the Luxor, and I went from there. I had fun. I make a lot of things for myself.
Well, it's really nice to be able to just do things when you want for yourself and not have to worry about everything having a price tag on it, and the things that are have a price tag, those are those things.
I decided when I moved here that I would not go and get one of these great big houses. I thought this nice little house is just suitable for me.
So where do you do all this work? Not here in the living room. I mean, you might be thinking here, but...
Well, I can't show you on the radio.
No, but you'd be surprised what we can communicate.
Well, you want to take a look?
Sure.
Okay. This is my very first Egyptian thing I made, and I made this actually in Northridge back in 1959, around in that time.
It's a mosaic.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful time.
Well, one of the places that I work is here, and I'm working on a project here. Now, this is something I really hope to get done, and that's only part of it. I have most all those pieces cut out. And in the garage, I have a great big kiln.
Before we leave this one, you're working pieces of glass on top of a drawing that you've made.
Right. I do all this drawing. I draw everything out, then I cut out all the pieces. Now, most of all these pieces have already been cut out. They're elsewhere.
So all these individual pieces in terms of the fusing process will be put onto one or two other sheets of glass?
They'll be put on clear glass.
Back and front?
No,
or just one?
Just on the back of it. And it's going to be four pieces of glass, so I have to design this to where I'm going to fuse this outer ring first to set the glass, and then I can come back and put the other pieces on, which you do by glue, and then I can carry it in one piece and put it in the kiln. That's the only way I'll be able to get these pieces to go back into where they belong.
The glue is just, it burns off in the kiln.
It burns off, and it's just ordinary school glue.
And is this a reversal of the image, or is this the...
That's it, but there's a lot more to it.
Right. You're not working backwards.
No. Mosaics, you do work upside down, I understand.
Quite sometimes. Often, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I don't. This is my clay mess out here. This, I have a wheel I don't use very often. This is my big, basically, the kiln I use most of the time. And this is a kiln that I pretty well had them design at Paragon, and they now produce this kiln.
Oh.
Well, it's a prototype. It's what I wanted. It's got, on the top, coils around the side and on the door.
Okay, because they often didn't have them on the top?
Not on the top, and that gives you an even temperature over your glass. See, most of your kilns that people were using were ceramic kilns.
Right. Mm-hmm. And, or enameling kilns.
Yeah. Right, and they didn't give even temperature. But now they have glass kilns up the kazoo, so...
But you helped them.
Well, I specified that this is what I wanted, and they made it for me, but now they produce it. And then this is just a little kiln that I do test work in.
You are listening to Ears on Art. Today's guest is Ina May Overman, and the topic is fused glass. We rejoin her now as she shows us another important room in her house.
Now we go out. This is basically where I do the glass cutting. I do the design in that room there you saw, and I do most of my glass cutting out here, or sometimes I in there, but most of the time right here. And I have tools, but tools. And the fact the fellow that I took the stained glass with in Granada Hills was the one that developed the Glass Star grinder, which is very famous now. Everybody has a Glass Star grinder, most everybody. So I was very fortunate. But in those days, we didn't have grinders.
So glass fusing really came fairly late in the glass world. I mean, obviously, people have been blowing glass for centuries.
Yes. Well, glass fusing has been done, but it was just like mosaics, went out of fashion, more or less, and it never got going because these kilns weren't made for it.
So basically, you're dealing with a minimum of two layers of glass that get heated and fused together. About how long does it take to take the glass through the fusing process?
I can bring it up probably within about 4 hours. I can get it up to its melting point, and then it takes probably another, bringing it on down and letting it cool off probably another 5-6 hours. And even glass has an annealing.
Annealing is a term that basically says we're taking stress out of a material so it doesn't
same
explode.
Same thing with your metals.
Yeah, with the metals so that we can hit it,
right.
And with glass so that it doesn't go
right.
Ping! But is that a good imitation?
That was very good.
I listen to these craft programs, and they show all these fusing artists, and they tell how long their stuff has been in the kiln, and I think it's a bunch of hooey.
I guess glass has that definite property that it's always in motion, even though it doesn't look like it to us.
It's a liquid.
Right.
It actually is a liquid. George taught me that.
Yeah.
This was a shed that my son-in-law, who has since passed away, made for storage, and I then thought, oh, this would be great. I used to do it upstairs, and I got to where I couldn't. I have a little loft in my garage, and I can't carry the glass up there anymore. Mm-hmm. So I redid this, had it all wired, and put insulation in and everything. Perfect. I even got a heater. The only thing I'm lacking is telephone, and I'm going to work on that pretty soon.
You had talked earlier about your enjoyment of working three-dimensionally. So the glass is coming in flat sheet. You're cutting it up. You're fusing it.
Well, you slump it then.
And then talk about slumping.
Well, slumping's over in molds or into molds, bowls, and but I used to do three-dimensional over molds, but I don't hardly do that anymore because I'm getting lazy. You fuse it first, and then you slump it a second time over, so it's running the kiln actually twice.
A lot of the work that I've seen over the years that you've enjoyed leaving some open spaces, often kind of, not grid patterns, but I mean places where they're areas of glass and then a space where things bridge across. And
well,
besides the transparency of the glass, there's a dimensional nature to that.
Yeah, but there's a method for that. It's because I quite frequently, if it's a one solid flat sheet, I will get sometimes a bubble will form and then ruin the whole thing. Mm-hmm. So if I put those little strips and holes in it, I don't have that problem. Now, I've been keeping that a secret, but... We got so many fusers now in the county that they don't know all these little secrets.
Well, the small amount of it I've done certainly lets me know that the whole process of the kill firing is absolutely critical to the finished outcome, right?
Yes. But I do utilize a lot of my engineering in this work.
Well, that, I think, was maybe why I asked the question before. So that carryover? What sorts of ways do you find yourself making use of it?
Well, in my designs are very rigid, and the way I make form it, I just design it to where it will work and things of that nature. That's just an engineering mind.
Your templates that we see lying about here for your various designs are very, very technically drawn.
I was a draftsman in the days when you drafted. If I had to do it on the computer, forget it.
Right.
Because I refuse to learn to work a computer. Anyhow, that's it for that. This room.
Oh, that's cool. I mean, it's always great to see how people make good use of available space. Mm-hmm. You had mentioned that you were using glass that other people were not using, so have you had to teach yourself a lot of stuff about its temperatures and factors and coefficients?
Well, I just used one brand of glass. It's a German-made glass, and it's basically was made for stained glass, you know, and I just have been able to use it. And since I've used it, this has been many years now, they have now made that where all of their colors are compatible. Not because I use it. They don't know me from Adam, but but it's because of the fusing world.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It's called GNA, Desaug glass. I'm now using what Spectrum 96. I find it's easiest to cut of all of the new glasses.
Do you end up with buckets of scrap pieces?
Yes, and I utilize a lot of my scrap in my bowls and stuff that I make. That's obvious.
Waste not, want not.
Right.
Especially with expensive material.
Right. I'd like to be able to do more mosaic. But I haven't found a glue that you can glue onto a surface that will not show streaks through it when you hold it up to the light.
So the UV glues don't work. Oh,
that's too expensive.
Ah.
I buy a little tube of that. It runs around $5. But I've now got a new glass that Loctite's put out that's called glass glue, and it's not required to use UV. But I am not using that either. It's too expensive. But I haven't got that far yet. I will. I want to show you my big pride and joy.
Okay.
Which has nothing to do with the art world.
That's fine.
It's the automotive world.
Well, you're defining it as not part of the art world.
It was in my past. The automotive customized car and everything was in the past. I used to show cars. I'm sure you'll know what it is.
Well, my goodness. A Shelby GT?
And the funny part of it is I don't even know how to drive it. My daughter has to drive me around.
Yeah, that's a classic.
I have done nothing to this. This is a brand new one. Uh-huh. 2007 Shelby GT500. But I used to have one in 1968, and I was determined I was going to get another Shelby. Mm-hmm. And here it sits.
Here it sits.
In all its grabber orange color.
You made reference to some other car that you had shown or
yes, done. I had a 1952 Lincoln, which I completely redesigned and had it redone by Valley Custom, which was very well known in those days. And I used to show it. I was down at the Pan Pacific Auditorium. I think that's what we call that place.
Mm-hmm. I think so, too.
Yeah. Twice in the Motoramas, and I've done a lot of things automotively. My brother and I, we traveled clear down to almost Guatemala following the Pan American Road Race. Mm-hmm. I've just done a lot with automobiles during my past.
My sense is that this has been a fairly good kind of blending for you over the years.
I've had a very, very good life. My husband was killed in the war, the Korean War, and I raised my kid, but I had a great family that helped with that. I've had an excellent job, and I've done exciting things. And I'm very happy with my life.
And it seems that you're continuing to do so.
No, I can't complain.
Well, I mean, there's an obvious sense of fun in the colors, the use of the glass speaks to that fun. Letting people know that there's definitely, as they say, life after retirement.
Oh, definitely.
Well, it appears that, you know, you've figured out a whole lot of things and done problem solving, which is obviously part of an engineer's job, is to figure out solutions for things, right? So
Well, I've done a lot of firsts, too, and that's
right.
What I like.
Well, thank you so much for giving up part of your afternoon so that we could come and learn more about what you do. And it is definitely impressive, and I have always enjoyed walking by the Art Center or walking in and seeing one more piece hanging there. So
I'm very fortunate. That's why I like to do it.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. That's it.
That can be it.
Ina May was just that kind of person. When she said it was done, it was done. Our history goes back a long ways. Not quite sure where we exactly met, but chances are we overlapped at the Cuesta Foundry classes. But most of my memories have their origins at the San Luis Obispo Art Center. For many, many years, the Art Center was kept open by volunteers. It was open 6 days a week, and the standard shift was from 11 until 2. The late afternoon shift was handled by some meagerly paid employees. I don't know if Ina May was there once a month or more often, but it was such a treat to walk in and find her behind the desk, always greeting people with a cheerful hello and ready to share some story. I always counted on her to be very straight with her judgments, with her opinions, with her take on whatever might be happening. She was an active member of the Central Coast Craftmakers, an affiliate artist group of the Art Center, which in the early days had an annual juried exhibit. Since we were all volunteers with that, it certainly required people coming in and doing their share, and Ina May was often one of those volunteers. The reference was made during this program to the fused glass window hangings that Ina May would regularly display at the Art Center. In fact, you really could count on one of them being in a window just about any time you were there. I will regret for a long time that I never purchased one. Not quite sure why I wasn't that bright. As time passed, it was fun to watch the work grow. As she says, they showed her engineering mind. They were full of color and always a little element of something unexpected. With her death at 91 goes a chunk of the Art Center history. And admittedly, I'm feeling that emptiness more and more. In the 80s, it was definitely a place where we met, became friends, challenged each other, and enjoyed not just our art, but that of many other people as well. It was a special time. I will miss her loyalty. I will miss her friendship. And most certainly, the art community has lost a strong and vital member. To see some of her work and to get a full description of her redesign of her 1952 Lincoln Capri, simply do a web search for Ina, I-N-A, May, M-A-E, Overman, O-V-E-R-M-A-N. You have been listening to Ears on Art. Today, we have been honoring three artists whom we unfortunately lost in 2013. Janine Kirkpatrick, Barbara Flynn, and Ina May Overman. I am Chrissy Hewitt, and
this is Stephen DeLuque. Thank you for listening.